What's up, Dialed fam? Happy Wednesday and welcome to the Strength Training for Cyclists podcast by Dialed Health. My name is Derek Teal. I'm the owner and operator of Dialed Health. And as always, I'm excited to be here. I really am. And now that I'm in the groove of doing these podcast episodes again, I think of things throughout the week and even as I'm training and I'm like, man, I got to talk about that. In fact, I was just talking my wife's ear off this morning about something I wanted to include on the podcast. And so it's nice to have this outlet to you guys because I really wish I could communicate with everyone on an individual level, but this is my next best thing because I just can't. I mean, I'm very grateful that the Dialed fam is growing to the point where I just can't talk to everyone on the phone like I used to because I used to actually provide that as part of my service. And although it's really fun to connect with everybody and helpful, it's just inefficient long term. And I think ultimately what I can bring to you guys through dialedhealth.com is going to be better to have these resources at your fingertips when I step back and do things in a higher capacity, I guess, higher volume load, if we want to talk training there. So thank you for listening today. We have some really cool topics and I have a lot of prep in front of me. I'm looking at my computer screen, very proud of this organization. And let me give you a rundown on what we're going to talk about. Now, I did an Instagram Q&A and we have some really fun light questions and we have a few deeper questions. So it's going to be a nice mix of both. We're going to talk today about if row machines are good for cycling or not. We're going to talk about food volume and how you feel full. High calorie and calorically dense foods versus low calorie dense foods that are large, high volume. What's the difference and why would you eat one opposed to the other? We're also going to talk about how much time you can take off training before losing performance. I think you are going to be pretty devastated at that one. And then we're going to get into a discussion on bad riding equipment, how I think it's a huge advantage, especially in your beginning of your riding career. And then we go into a little personal update about myself and some info about the Dialed Health Shred that I'm starting to put together. I hinted last week about it in the episode, and you're kind of the first to hear about what's going to be going on this January because it's a few months out still, but with what I want to provide, it's still just enough time to get everything done. So stay tuned. It's going to be a great episode. As always, if you have a question, you can email me, derek@dialedhealth.com. Let me know what you want me to talk about. I'm happy to answer your question directly. I also like knowing your Instagram handle so I can tag you there. And if you want to just give me a little shout out on the gram, screenshot this, please post it to your story, tag Dialed Health. It makes a huge difference in the show's exposure and just getting it out there to your friends and gaining the followers on Instagram because we're coming up on 9,000. And when we hit 10, I can actually link to stuff on my story. Like all these articles that I'm doing right now, of course I can link them on the show notes of the podcast, but throughout the week when I'm referencing certain material, there's so many pieces of content that I'm consuming that I could get out to you in a lot easier fashion if I had 10,000 followers. So, I mean, that's just a little plea there, but let's make this thing happen, okay? One of my goals is to have this done before the end of the year because although more followers has equated to more members on the website, which is great. That's the real purpose and goal behind it all. But also, it's like, this has just been the goal of like, let's get to 10K, get this swipe up feature, and let's start linking to some articles. It's just going to mean for more content. So anyways, thank you. Sit back, relax. Let's learn. We're going to start today's episode with a quick discussion about how riding lower end equipment can actually be a huge advantage. Now, I'm somebody who's definitely started trail riding this way because I took my Kona dirt jumper bike, my Kona Stuff, a 2003 Kona Stuff. What a legendary bike. And although it was great for dirt jumping, I took it out on actual trails. I started downhilling it. I did runs at North Star on this thing. And I'm going down Black Diamond downhill runs with 4-inch mechanical disc brakes that I have 4 fingers on, just hanging on for dear life. I have 4-inch fork that has no dampening at all. I mean, the thing was a pogo stick. And coming down, you just feel like you're on a shopping cart that's going to explode. In fact, a lot of lower end bikes, or if you buy an older used bikes, they can be pretty rickety. And it's just what you have to do to enter the sport if you don't have a lot of disposable income. I think we all know as experienced riders how expensive bikes can be. And coming into the sport new, even if you have the money to drop on a bike, maybe you don't want to right away because you don't know if you love the sport or not yet. I mean, I think that's a really great idea to not just go blow 10 grand on a bike when you don't even know if you're going to ride it frequently. So being okay with having lower end equipment is really important because of a couple things. So for one, if you're new to the sport, you're feeling it out. You want to know if you like it or not. But if it's your only option, you have a huge advantage on people who can come into the sport and ride equipment that is just top of the line or even like mid-range, let's just say expert level builds where you're spending $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 on a bike. I know it's a lot of money, but that truthfully is like mid-range for a mountain bike or a road bike. So that's just the reality. I guess I'm just numb to it at this point. I have, blown all of my money on bikes all through my life. All the money I've made through working and traveling is just, to me, it's just like it is what it is. I love riding. That's why I do it. But if you can't afford it, you actually have a huge advantage. As frustrating as it is, trust me, I understand when there's a piece of equipment you feel like you want, you need it, but you can't have it. It's still an advantage because I'm just going to say most likely one day you're going to get it if you keep riding for the long haul. But for now, you have to focus on what's even more important, which people who can get that equipment right away will never probably do this. I'm trying to change that narrative, but you are going to have to focus on your body so much more than those people. You're going to have to focus on feeling the trail. You actually thinking about your technique. If you're out riding a rickety hardtail on some kind of rougher trails, and your brakes don't work as well, you're going to have to brake earlier. You're going to have to absorb impact with your body. You're going to have to make sure that your weight is distributed more evenly around corners because your suspension isn't as good, which means your traction isn't as good. And your body is going to have to do more work than the bike is going to do for you. Whereas those other people are on the opposite side of the scale. So although maybe they're enjoying the ride a little bit more right away, long term, they might not break through that wall of having to learn those real fundamentals, whereas you are. And again, you're doing it the harder way. But I want to encourage you because I get that there's this huge barrier in entering our sport. I mean, the greatest sport ever. I love it so much. And I'm happy that there's more affordable options out there. There are, some great hardtails that are being built for people to go out and experience riding in a good way. But it's still not that dream build that you see on Instagram. So if that's you, get out. Focus on your body position and just really understand that, I'm going to get better and better and better. And by the time I do get that better piece of equipment, then I'm actually going to notice it. That's another thing. A lot of these people, they don't even know how good their product is. They think they need more and more and more. And I'm like, oh my gosh, no, like you have not even come close to maximizing what that bike can do. Trust me. I know it's not what, Jesse Melamed is riding, top EWS racers. I know it's not what Peter Sagan's on. But why are you comparing yourself to this person? Like, let's be realistic here. Like, just for the record, that person on your piece of equipment, just think about what they could do. And I think that will put it in perspective because even though I'm kind of contradicting my comparison thing, you have to think of that. It's like, what is really possible with what you have? And coming from that angle is going to make you such a better rider long term. And then you'll notice the improvements when you get them, and you'll also appreciate them a whole lot more. So I've been through this ringer, and I just want to encourage you to get out there and focus on your body, man, or woman, whichever. Okay, let's get into questions. We're now jumping into our Instagram Q&A, and the first question was actually asked by two different people, and so I'll read both of their questions and then answer them together. They're very similar. So the first one is from @TyMills122_. He wrote, "What are your thoughts on rowing for cardio? During the winter, I tend to do more rowing, 10Ks, etc., over the spin bike just for something different. Do you think this is fine, or should I spend more time on the spin bike and just row occasionally to get the most benefits for mountain biking?" Now, the next person, very similar question. @RandyChipman, wrote, "What do you think of the rower as good cross-training to the bike?" Now, the truth is, the row machine is nowhere near as beneficial as getting on a spin bike was. And I'm sorry I had to pause there for a second because I'm like, how do I get this across in a way that doesn't trigger people? The truth is, a spin bike is going to have so much more benefit. It's not even funny. It's not even close, because think about the real movement that you're doing and what your body's adapting to. Now, there is a catch here, and there's a point where switching it up and having some row machine in your program can be very beneficial. But that is most likely not until you're hitting a certain minimum of riding. In my opinion, and I'd say experience, I don't have some science to back this up right now, but I would say unless you're pedaling 4 days a week, I would prioritize the spin bike as your primary cardio, quote unquote, workout. If you want something to directly help your mountain biking, get on the spin bike and pedal, because there is so much adaptation to be done just through that same action by simply switching up the intervals or doing an endurance ride or doing, you know, a sweet spot, threshold, VO2. Are you going to be doing full-on sprint work? The variance there is almost infinite. And the adaptation you can get is so high that unless you're doing it to a certain minimum, you probably shouldn't waste your time supplementing those workouts with a row machine workout. Now, would the row machine workout be better than nothing on that day? Yeah, absolutely, because you're still getting that cardiovascular work in, and I would never deny that. It's not that you can't grow cardiovascularly, but when you're on the bike, your legs, the adaptation that's happening just in your legs is so much different than what's happening just in your lungs. Like there's way more to it than just conditioning your lungs. There's muscular endurance and weird muscles in your back and your arms and your triceps and your neck when you spend a lot of time on the bike that do adapt and make riding feel a lot easier. So I like to input rowing into programs as a warm-up. You'll see this on like the off-season enduro program. And it's a great way to, again, you use your back, you use different muscle groups, and you are still doing things that have a similar benefit as the bike. But again, it's like the specificity of being on the bike and pedaling, you just cannot beat it. So I would say that rowing is a great way to cross train for the bike as long as you're hitting your riding minimums. Now, if you need to do it just simply for your brain capacity, like you are just so sick of pedaling that you're either not going to do it, you're not gonna do anything, or you're just gonna row, I would just row. Or if you're like, okay, you know what, it's the off season, I don't want to ride 5 days a week or 4 days a week, I'm gonna ride 2 days a week and do two rows, that's gonna be so much more beneficial than just riding 2 days a week and that's it. So don't take this so far in one direction, but I'm just being honest with you. Spinning on the bike is gonna have way more of an impact on your riding than rowing, but it's not really just one or the other. There's a lot of things in between that. So you keep that in mind as you're making those decisions. Again, I don't think it's bad for you to be on the row machine, but do what is going to allow you to be the most consistent, because even more rowing and less riding done consistently is going to be better than just not riding at all. So keep that in mind. This next question is from @the.goodsimon. This is Amber Simon, and she's responding to an Instagram story I did all about the benefits of Brussels sprouts. And so I'll read her question, and then I'll kind of fill you in on what I was talking about. Now, Quincy, this is her husband. Dude, she kind of throws you under the bus, but let's get into it. And also, if you have kids in the car, earmuffs, okay? Just brief earmuffs. Here's the question. Can you go into more detail about how eating high-volume foods while within macros is okay, even when the portion size looks monstrous? Quincy gives me so much shit about my monster salads because he doesn't think that the large portions are quote unquote needed, even within macros. Now, what I was talking about with Brussels sprouts is so funny. I love the husband and wife dilemma too, because this is so real. Now, the reason Lish doesn't like me eating high volume foods like this is because of gas. When you eat a lot of leaves, it traps air as it goes into your stomach. And guess what? It's got to come out somewhere. All right. So there's a lot of angles to this question. But I was talking about Brussels sprouts because you can eat, this is what high volume foods means. You can eat literally 16 ounces, so 1 pound of Brussels sprouts, for under 200 calories. It comes in just under 200 calories. There's 0 grams of fat. There's like 16 grams of protein. It's just an incredible food, very dense. And it's good to know that there are calories. You know, this is a green. Not everyone tracks their greens, but there are some that are more dense than others. And this is like a, I don't want to use the word dense because it could be confusing down the road, but let's just say it's good to track your vegetables when you're going to eat a lot of them. Now, you have 200 calories worth of Brussels sprouts. This is like the size of my head, literally. I mean, it's a lot. You should almost just weigh them out to see. It's a lot of Brussels sprouts. Now, what's great about this is because I can eat those and actually feel full without going over on my macros, or, you know, they just fit really well within my diet. I can stay on track. I can feel full. But here's actually what's happening. So there's a few different ways that you can feel full. You have two different receptors. Well, there's more, but we're going to keep it simple. And I first saw this on the Forks Over Knives documentary. I don't know if you guys remember that on Netflix a while ago. I really don't agree with everything that they say. However, this was very interesting. They show a basically food going into someone's stomach. It's kind of like this cartoon drawing. But as you fill up your stomach, you have receptors on the outside, these stretch receptors that tell you when you're full. So when you just pack your stomach full of food and it fills up and starts expanding, you hit those stretch receptors and it signals to your brain that you're full. Now, you also have density receptors. These are on the inside of your stomach, and they kind of determine how many calories are in your stomach. So when you get as many calories as you need, or you go into excess, even though your stomach may not be full of foods, it's going to tell you that you're full and that you've had enough. But what's weird is that you're getting the signal that you've had enough, but you don't feel that physical fullness. There's no stretch to your actual stomach. So this, a great example of this kind of food and the extreme of this kind of food would be just oil. So fat has the highest calories per gram as anything, and oil is pure fat, basically. So when you have a stomach full of oil, if you compared like 500 calories of oil versus 500 calories of Brussels sprouts, you can almost visualize how different your stomach would look. One with the oil would have the oil kind of sitting at the bottom of your stomach with those density receptors signaling, while the other one doesn't have the density receptors signaling necessarily, but it has the stretch receptors signaling. And this is so interesting because there are times when you are very hungry and you need calories. We especially feel this as athletes and cyclists, and you can eat high volume foods, which means low calorie foods, stretch your stomach out, your stomach's stretched, and you're almost like, whoa, like I almost feel bloated, I'm so full, but you still have the shakes because you didn't get enough calories. I have felt that firsthand, and it's the weirdest thing ever, because you're like, I'm full, but I'm still so freaking hungry. And a lot of people associate this with not being quote unquote satisfied, and I think it's good to kind of see the difference, because you know, being satiated does come down to feeling your body and giving it what it needs, but it's also very habitual. There's a lot of emotional kind of triggers that come along with it. So I would just say that there's, you know, obvious people who like to feel full in the stretch capacity sense, and then there's some people who just want the higher caloric food and are willing to eat less of it. Now, I have a great example, and I didn't even think about this before the episode, but I'm tracking my food right now. And yesterday, I finished my dinner and I had 250-ish calories left, literally all carbs and all carbs and fat, mostly carbs. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. I can legit eat just, I don't know, some popcorn, or I have Oreos right now in my pantry. I could eat 3 Oreos and I could have like 6 ounces of this almond milk eggnog I got. And that was my plan. So I started dipping these Oreos in my almond milk nog. I measured everything and I ate one Oreo and I was like, oh my gosh, I am too hungry to literally stop at 3 Oreos right now. I do not have the mental discipline to do that. Although you can eat Oreos and get shredded, you have to stop at like 2. And that is so difficult, especially when you're physically hungry. So I just aborted the mission. I had my one Oreo. I poured my almond milk back in the jug and I went and grabbed a couple rice cakes because I was like, you know what? I could have 2 honey nut rice cakes, which is going to be basically equal out those Oreos and the eggnog and feel a little bit more full. I drank a bunch of water while I was having those. And you know what? I did feel more full. Even though I felt like I wanted just that satiating bite of the Oreo, it wasn't going to just fill up my stomach enough for me to feel actually satisfied. So those are 2 things to consider. And I want you to know that even the gas is like a joke that I mentioned. It is actually a variable to eating high volume foods because there's, you know, you can, I don't know, you're just going to feel differently and you have to try it out to see what's better for you. But the reality is eating more high volume foods probably going to be healthier because you're going to have to reach for more natural foods that aren't as calorically dense. Probably, because then again, avocados, very calorically dense, completely natural, one ingredient. So one option is going to give you maybe more nutrition and like micronutrients, but also maybe you have some stuff that comes along with it, like gas. Maybe you feel a little bloated because you feel you're like your stomach is too stretched. And then on the other side, you could feel like tighter and leaner and your stomach is smaller. Maybe you have less gas, but you feel a little less satiated. So there is a balance there, and it's okay to not always be one way. You can do one night and one the other night or day or whatever, but try each out. There is a difference, and I hope that clears it up. So in regards to answering the question, I think the real question was, can you stay on track and eat these large quantities? The answer is yes, but it does come with other variables like I just mentioned. This next question is from @AdamCVW. Adam, what's happening, man? This is a very light, fun question. We're talking about mountain biking here. He just asked simply, steep chutes or big drops with the transition? This is a really good question. Now, although I love riding both, I will say that big drops with the transition, oh man, that's a satisfying feeling. When you get that full on free fall and you pull it off smooth, that might feel better than cleaning a steep chute. But I've also ridden down things where I really don't know if I'm going to make the corner at the bottom. And when you make it, that also feels great. But I'll say that I like steep chutes, but really, really long steep trails kind of get annoying to me because I just feel like I'm riding the brakes the whole time. I mean, I think a lot of people feel that way. I know some people who love steep trails all the time. And I typically run big rotors just because I don't like the feeling of just frying my brakes out. But yeah, a steep, quick chute, it's pretty fun, especially when it's technical and it's not just like a straight line. But a big drop of transition, I think I'm going to go for that one. I don't know. I like to free fall a little bit. This next person asked two questions, so I'll answer the first one before moving on to the second one. This is from @JohnnyT. First question, advice for training remotely with a significant other. How do you encourage each other? This is an incredible question, and I've trained many couples in person, and so I can really speak on this. I've seen the dynamic, and it can go a whole lot of ways. And even when I was a trainer but less experienced, there were times where I tried to write my wife training programs or just correct her form. I train my wife in person. It's just very interesting how you can and can't be effective. So let me talk about the most important thing first, and then just something I've noticed watching couples interact while they work out together. The first thing, if you want to encourage your spouse, you have to lead by example. This is the most important thing. You can't just keep staring at each other like, are you going to do it? 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 If they're blowing it that day, you have to be the one who takes the reins and sets the example. You have to be the one to make up for their lack of willpower or discipline or commitment or whatever it is and say, hey, I know that you're feeling weak right now. I'm continuing with this. And when you're ready to come back, I'll be here. Vice versa, because the dynamic's probably going to shift. So don't go in together like we're all in or we're all out together. When someone else is feeling weak, that's when you have to pick up the slack and be strong for them. You telling them what to do or saying, we need to do this, we need to do this, it's really not going to work. You cannot wait for the other person. You have to go in with the right intentions together. You kind of know what direction you want to go, and you have to make up for that other person's weak point. That is, I think, the only thing that works. I really do. You can't just bail out together. Someone's got to be there as that foundation and that solid rock to keep the momentum going forward. And like I said, it could shift back and forth. So when you notice your significant other drifting, you have to be willing to pick up their slack. That's the biggest advice I'd give for encouraging. Lead through example, through your action, not your words. Don't put it back off on them. Do not do it. So other than that, what I'll say, because I've trained only like man and woman couples where the husband feels the constant need to mansplain. And mansplaining is a real epidemic in the gym. It's the real pandemic of 2020, is mansplaining. When you are training with your, that's probably going to get me like flagged with China or something. Anyways, don't say China. What? Did I say China? Stop saying China. Okay, I'm back. So if you are training with your significant other, what I've seen, the husband and wife dynamic, I can't speak on, two women in the relationship or two men, but husband and wife, if the wife is doing something wrong, it's like the husband has to stop immediately and correct what they're doing. And although it's good to keep each other safe, it can be very frustrating for the wife that feel like when she feels like the husband is looking and paying more attention to her than he is on himself, there's like a weird pressure and discomfort it creates. And I've watched it happen in person. In fact, I've seen husbands and wives like correct each other, usually the husband correcting the wife, while I'm right there and I'm watching. And the thing is, as a really good coach, you know that you can't correct everything at once. There's perfect form, but then a level below that is kind of just being safe. And you have to get a person safe, and then you can, you know, nitpick it and make it better and better and better and more efficient and more effective. But if someone has four different things going wrong, I'm not going to probably pick all four. I mean, you're going to just tell them one thing that's the most important and move on from there. Like, for example, if someone's doing a deadlift and their back is round from their tailbone all the way up to their skull, I'm not going to say, hey, you need to load up your heels and you need to brace your stomach and reach your butt back a little more and focus on your hip hinge. Now you need to pack your shoulders and I want you to look ahead. Now take a deep breath and then exhale as you come up. Like, I'm not going to say, if you say all that to someone who's just learning or has 10 problems and you try and correct even five of them, it's going to be too much. You have to pick the most important thing that just keeps them safe. And then you go from there. So for me, I'm like, I'm doing my job. Like, you don't need to jump in and correct this. But I get it, because you want the best for the other person. And sometimes it's obvious when someone's form isn't correct. So what I would say is, make sure someone's safe. And if they are, or your significant other's safe, if they are, you know, safe but not perfect, I would just let it slide. Honestly, I wouldn't say anything. Focus on your own movement and lead by example. Okay, next question from the same person. What's your opinion on ADHD and cycling, especially when it comes to training? I don't know. I've never actually thought about this. It's a very interesting conversation to have. I don't have ADHD, although sometimes maybe it feels like it, not to be insensitive or anything, but I've never really put a lot of a thought on it. I have trained people with learning disabilities and a little bit, I don't want to say more extreme, but that cause for more, I'd say, actual physical impairment. But here's what I would say. I can't speak on this directly, but people tend to have a short attention span in general when it comes to their training. And so this is not going to answer your question directly, but I think it's a great lesson for everyone listening, because I watch it over and over again. It's very hard to see. Now, it's exciting to feel like you're getting on track and to get that new program and to try these new things, and you just got a Fitbit and you got a fresh pair of shoes and now you have a new gym membership. You got all this stuff. You're stoked, right? You're feeling on top of the world. And then you do your first month, and then you realize, oh, I just have to keep doing this over and over again. And that's when people start losing attention, even though they're getting results, even though they're making progress. I mean, I just got not called out on Trainer Road by this, but Trainer Road answered one of my questions recently. And the truth was, it was like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What you're doing is working. You just need to keep going. It's not that what you're doing now isn't going to take you further. It's that, or like, you don't need to keep doing more until you hit really a plateau. And then you can kind of readjust your training plan. And that's a lot with training. It's like, people just lose their attention. And even though it's completely working and they just got to stay on track, they're ready for the new thing. And that's where their attention deficit comes in to play. I'm sorry if this sounds insensitive, but this is just my comparison. It's like, people want that new fresh thing, and when it's not new and fun anymore, they lose interest, and it's really sad to see, even when they're making progress. So that's all I can really say on the topic. I hope that helps some other people, and I'm sorry that doesn't answer it directly. The next question is from @hsteimer. Kettlebells. It looks like you always use competition style. Is there a benefit to those versus cheaper ones? Yeah, there is a benefit. Competition style kettlebells, as you probably noticed on dowdhealth.com or even in my Instagram videos, they're all the same size. They're a different color, and each color represents a different weight, but they're all shaped exactly the same. I like that because it takes away one less variable when people are learning and practicing a movement where they want to keep increasing weight steadily. So for coaching, it makes that really nice. It's also easy in group classes when I can just say, go grab the yellows, go grab the blues, go grab the orange. And it's just a quick kind of thing I've learned through experience that is helpful for just to simplify the coaching experience. And from there, I'd say maybe the comfort on your wrist. The competition bells are a little bit more round. They're a little bit larger, and it tends to be more comfortable in the rack position. Whereas, especially, this is the difference between competition bells and cheap bells. You can buy cheap kettlebells that are very poor shape, that have sharp corners all over them, and they're just going to dig into your body. You don't want that. You want to be able to roll around with a bell, basically, and have it be comfortable. So if you see sharp corners on a kettlebell, steer away from it. But other than that, the difference between competition bells and standard bells is just really the shape. And standard bells actually have a huge advantage on the handle for some things, like a goblet squat, for example, can be a lot more comfortable with a standard kettlebell handle because the bell handle actually curves out from the bell before it reconnects into the handle. And that's a nice anchor when you're in that goblet rack position. Or even if you're doing Russian twist and you're holding it similarly, and the bell's right side up, but you're just kind of holding the sides, that can be a lot harder to do on a competition bell because the handles go straight up from the bell before they reconnect at the top. There's no sharp corners, but even on halos, kettlebell halos, a competition bell, I have to put my thumbs up on the bell, whereas standard bell, I can just wrap my thumbs around the handle because of the shape of the handle. And I do appreciate that about standard bells. I actually have some at home that I use. I just don't bring them to the gym. They're kind of my, you know, safety equipment just in case I need something and I can't get my workout in at the gym when I need it. And that's really it. I also love the rawness to standard bells. Even though competition bells look cool, they're painted, they're really cozy and comfy when you use them. They're fun. You know, standard bells are just raw. Like, they just look gnarly to me. I love the idea of just throwing around this hunk of metal with no paint on it. It's kind of cool. So those are the differences. I would just say watch out for sharp corners if you do decide to buy a cheaper bell. This next question is from @JackieLegs_12. A little depressing for me on this one because even though I knew the answer, I dove into healthline.com to get some more clarity and some real tangible examples for you guys. And they pointed something out that I was like, oh my gosh. So the question is, how much time can you safely take off without losing performance? And this is in regards to training. The thing that they brought up, which I never really considered, but oh my gosh, it's obvious. It literally is just common sense. The answer to this is that it depends on your pre-break fitness level. The fitter you are, the faster it goes. Oh, doesn't that hurt? That just like jabs me in the stomach right there. The fitter you are, the faster it goes. And this just makes sense because if you're at a lower level of fitness, you're doing less per week to maintain that level of fitness. And when you take time off, it's not as drastic as someone who's doing a lot taking time off. There's just way more contrast. I mean, that is purely logical. And they're considering someone who strength trains 2 to 5 days per week as a higher level performer. And for a lot of us, we're doing way more than that. Some are doing less. I mean, if you are doing less than that right now, this is your time to shine because you can take more time off and there's not as much of a detriment to your fitness level. But really, it's just because you're not at a higher fitness level. So it's just it's a funny thing to point out and kind of a sad reality. It kind of reminds me when I think about how hard it is to burn calories versus eat calories. You know, I could eat, you know, 500 calories in literally like 2 minutes and it's going to take me an hour to burn it. It's just so sad. I dove into one of their studies and I'm just going to read this verbatim. I just copied and pasted it from the website, so don't flag me down here, but this is pretty interesting. It says, a recent study looked at 21 runners who participated in the 2016 Boston Marathon and then cut back on their exercise. They went from running about 32 miles a week to 3 or 4 miles a week. After 4 weeks of this reduced routine, the runner's cardio fitness had dropped significantly. You lose cardio or aerobic fitness more quickly than muscle strength, and this can start happening in just a few days. According to a 2012 study, in athletes, endurance decreases between 4 and 25% after 3 to 4 week break in cardio. Beginners may find their aerobic fitness is back to zero after a 4 week break. Back to zero. You go from doing nothing, you finally start, you have a good month, you take a month off, and you're back to zero. It's so messed up. And for even higher performers to notice a drop in a few days, it makes sense. It really does. And for your cardiovascular ability to drop quickly, and they're saying, you know, 3 to 4 weeks can drop up to 25%. Oh my gosh, 25%? And you extrapolate that, like if you are a higher level performer, you're doing things like that are insane for the most marginal like 0.5% gains. And you think about taking time off and you can lose up to 25%. Oh my gosh. I don't know why this is so funny to me. I think it's like a denial thing I'm in right now. But just so you know also, strength training, they said it's typically a 3 to 4 week drop. Or 3 to 4 weeks off before seeing a significant drop. I did know that strength training, you retain your strength a lot longer. I will say there is a lot to be said about muscle activation and really being able to fire and recruit all of your muscle fibers. Now, that isn't something, yes, you could probably just do it on some crazy fight or flight response, but the reason that taking that time off, you may not feel as strong, even if technically you are, is probably for that reason. It's just the activation. Your muscles have gone a little dormant. It's still there. You just got to turn them back on. So that's the reality, you guys. The fitter you are, the faster it goes. If you are someone who's taking 3 to 4 weeks off at a time anyways, please start doing my programs. Please realize that you're taking 3 to 4 weeks off because of something major that's holding you back. It could be your current program. It could be your mindset. But you could be going back to zero each time, especially if you're just starting out. And keep that in mind. I mean, when you are consistent on your workout program, you have to remember how quickly it can go if you stop. And you don't want to keep going out of fear, but you have to be logical and understand that, hey, you know, what I'm working for is it's gone quick. It's a lot harder to gain than it is to lose. In fact, I just saw it was like a meme on Instagram. And it showed this guy on the beach just looking shredded. So, of course, I clicked on it. I mean, come on now. You know, shredded guys on the beach. So, there was one photo of him shredded, and then there's one photo of him that looked like he put on 30 pounds. I kid you not. I don't know what they did on this photo, but basically the shredded pic said 1 year of dieting. And then the other pic said 1 week of eating whatever I want. And I was like, oh my gosh, you could literally undo a year in a week. Pretty much. Now, BJ Goddard is a men's health trainer. And sorry, I'm going into a tangent here, but he talked about how in 1 week he put on 30 pounds after this bodybuilding show or shoot he did for men's health or whatever. And I really respect BJ Goddard as a trainer. I think he's almost kind of gone off the deep end on some things lately. And he definitely has his issues with food and expectations and social media and certain things like that. However, you can literally put on, I was like, I didn't know you could put on that much weight in a week. And when he talks about what he started eating, compared to what he was eating in this contest prep, it kind of made sense after that, but it's like, oh my gosh, like you can do so much damage. So anyways, I know I got really extreme on that with dieting and stuff. It's very interesting. Don't take time off, you guys. The next question is from @MTB_is_. Best training for a kid who wants to race enduro MTB. Now I'm going to answer this as I'm interpreting it because that's all the information I got. So when you say kid, I'm thinking 16 and under and probably someone who hasn't had much experience strength training. So the first thing I'd say is to really master the calisthenic fundamentals, body weight movements, push-ups, pull-ups, ab movements, core movements, animal flow like bear crawls. You want to be doing inchworms and walking lunges and really learn the abilities of your own body because it's going to help your coordination, but you're also decreasing the risk of injury. And I think when you're this young, it can be really dangerous to jump in a gym and start moving weights, especially with your buddies, because you know if you're in there with your friends, it's fun to go see who can bench press the most. But also, if you don't have a foundation of strength and you don't know what good form is, you're just really exposing yourself to injury. So be okay with just using your body weight because it's going to limit that risk a lot more. And you're really going to learn, like I said, just a lot of coordination. So avoid isolating any muscle groups. You probably don't need to do that. I'm assuming you don't have any compensations built up because you don't have these bad habits that have been, you know, compounded over years and years and years, like many adults do. And I would also pick something fun. You know, if you decide to grab some weight, grab a med ball and do some med ball throws. Or if you do decide to deadlift, really, really focus on your form. Like make form way more important than the weight that you actually pick up, because ingraining that movement pattern correctly when you're younger, it's going to stick with you for life. Beyond the just injury prevention thing, if you learn it and you train that movement pattern correctly versus incorrectly, you're going to probably be set for life. In fact, some of the most gratifying training I've done is with 14-year-olds where I do teach them how to deadlift and I do teach them how to squat and lunge and push up and do all these movements and a posterior tilt, and they get their core activated or hang from a bar with packed shoulders. In my head, and maybe I'm overthinking this, but I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to say I changed their life, but I'm like, they're probably going to move better for the rest of their life because the first time they did deadlifts, they did it right. The first time they did squats, they did it right. So you have a real opportunity when you're young to learn the movement patterns correctly, which is going to serve you for the rest of your life. And it's going to make you a faster rider too, but building that foundation is just so important. And I would also say stretch. I know you're young, you're probably already pretty mobile, but if you don't ingrain stretching now, you're gonna tighten up pretty dang quick, especially as you get more active. So make stretching a huge priority. Take a yoga class, you know, follow some stretch, follow my total body stretch routine. Stretch daily. It's totally okay. You may not need to hold positions as long as someone with these really tight muscles would, but if you don't let your body tighten up now and you carry this habit into your 20s, oh my gosh, you're gonna have such an advantage. So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this with the knowledge they have now would go back to their 16-year-old self and be like, yeah, I would learn how to do perfect push-ups. I'd be stretching every day and maybe I'd eat a piece of broccoli and not just Taco Bell every day. So consider all that, but that's where I would start. Next question is from @Stevenson with APH. Coming back from an injury, torn calf muscle, how to ease back without overdoing it? What I would really focus on as you're easing back, because you obviously have the precautions of putting too much pressure on your calf, probably anything, you're not doing triple extension, you're not jumping, you're not gonna decelerate or, you know, do some high knees thing where you're required to really use your Achilles and calf a ton. I'm sure there's a lot of stretching involved. And if you have a legit torn calf muscle, I'd highly recommend going to a PT to start this recovery process. But what I would say in regards to getting back into your strength training, first off, do what you can. If you have a torn calf muscle, you can get on a bench and do bench press. You could probably do one-legged push-ups where you throw your bum calf over your other one and get your push-ups going. You probably can't do hip hinges. There's probably not a ton of lower body movements you could do. Possibly some core work where you're doing leg raises or you're able to just actually work your abs. Any rowing upper body. I mean, don't give yourself an excuse not to do that. That is going to make a difference. And it's probably going to help your calf injury indirectly just through blood flow and moving oxygen around your body. So keep moving. But after you see your PT, you keep moving with your program or doing whatever you can currently. You really want to focus on the process. And you can do that by those workouts that I just mentioned that are modified. But even if you can't go in and do the normal squat weight you were before, you're probably not even close. Even if you are like, okay, I'm following, let's just say, the mid-season enduro plan, and I'm just going to be very easy with the movements I do that require me to actually use my calf muscle or put some strain on it. So if that means that you have to focus on the process and you're like, okay, I'm focused on my pre-workout nutrition. How much water am I drinking during my session? How's my form? Can I really improve my, can I spend more time in the warm-up and on the stretch? Can I spend more time after the workout with my stretches? Can I go up a little bit more on my upper body work and just do everything with body weight? And just focus on hitting your session, doing everything that you can, and that's all you can do. I wish I could say that, you know, you can just rub this on your calf and it's going to be better, but you're going to have to go through the PT process. You're going to have to slowly get back into leg work, and that's just how it is. However, if you build the habit of doing every single thing you can, even though stuff is modified, your ability to put in effort when you don't have these limitations is going to be so much easier. Trust me, I have worked through so many injuries. I've trained clients through it. The people that are willing to get work done while they just can't do everything, and they're not just so focused on what they can't do, they just focus on what they can do. So corny, but trust me, those are the people who long-term have the results, because then you get to a place where your calf feels better. Hopefully it rehabs 100% and you can get in the gym and you have no limits. Oh my gosh, how motivating is that? Because if you're willing to get it done while you do have the limitations and you're probably going through extra pain, just how much easier is it going to be when that's not there? Because it's not going to be there all the time. And that's what I'd recommend. Focus on the process, be consistent. And when you build that habit, it's going to make life post-injury way better. This is the last question. It is from @wardy1311. Do you actually need protein powder to build muscle and recover? In short, the answer is no. Here's the reason why protein powder is beneficial. It's because if you're hitting your protein numbers that are ideal for muscle growth and recovery, protein powder makes it honestly just easier to do. It adds a little variety to your diet. Maybe it feels better in your stomach because you're not eating as much lean protein through meats or eggs, or it's just like adding more variety. In fact, especially when you are dieting, the flavors of the protein powder can be really tasty. So it's a supplement to your diet, but it can be a very valuable staple of your diet as well. If you know you're going to have a scoop of protein powder every day, in my opinion, that's totally okay. There's different qualities of protein, and that's a whole other topic that we can get into. But I would say you don't need it to build muscle and recover, but it does help long-term consistency of hitting optimal protein levels. Now, there are arguments that say, okay, it's essentially liquid and it's going to digest faster. It's going to get to your muscles faster to repair. But really, if your protein's adequate throughout the day, it's spaced out evenly, your muscle recovery, there's more coming out that that's enough. And you don't have to eat within the 30-minute window. And it's funny because I'm experiencing right now something different with carbs, where if you don't eat pretty soon, if you're in a deficit and you did a hard workout, you start feeling shaky and bad pretty quick. But in regards to protein, no, I really don't believe that you need to eat the protein right after your workout. It doesn't have to be protein powder. But if you're getting adequate protein levels for the entire day and you're spacing it out, that's totally fine. Keep in mind, these powders are a great tool. All the supplements you'll see in the industry are a great tool, but there's even better marketers behind those products who are trying to make you feel like you need to absolutely take it. And although you don't absolutely need to take it, it does add a convenience, and there's reasons why people do it, like I just mentioned. So yeah, don't feel like you need it, but I would recommend it. I really would. You don't need it, but I'd recommend it. Before we go, I just want to follow up on the conversation we had last week about the Dialed Health Shred. So I was debating whether or not I should start my shred now or do it with you guys in January. But we just got confirmation that if my wife does not go into labor by 38 weeks, which is like January 20th, then they're going to induce her. So we're having these twins in January, and most likely they could come even earlier than that, especially like with the way that she's measuring and growing and all that stuff. Mid-January could be when they show up. And I don't think there's a worse time in my entire life than the month I have twins, add these babies into our life, when I'm trying to track and weigh and measure everything. I mean, come on. I don't like excuses, but really, it's the dumbest thing. I'm lost for words. It's so stupid. I'm not going to do it. And although I want to be in it with you guys during that process, I have decided to start early. In fact, I started last week, the day after last week's pod, because it just was so obvious to me what the answer was. And right away, I became so excited about starting early because of the content that I'm capturing. I just recorded the entire measuring process, how to, you know, test your body fat and when to weigh yourself and how to take tape measurements and do all this stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I can make so much added content to help you guys have a successful journey through the fat loss. And the goal is to have bigger prizes and just to stay way more involved. It's going to be for Dialed Health members only. And long story short, I'm doing the shred now, but it is the holidays. This is not an easy time to lose body fat, especially just to be honest, like at the lower body fat percentages, you have to be very, very strict. And what's crazy is in the matter of 1 week, although I haven't been perfectly strict, which I'll get into in a second, I have already lost almost 4 pounds, which is sick. I feel way less bloated. I feel lighter, but I've been pretty hungry for a few days. I'll be honest about that. And what I wanted to figure out at this time was, what do I allow? Because I have Friendsgivings coming up. I have real holidays. Halloween's a big thing in my family. And it's like the gnarliest day of eating ever besides Thanksgiving, probably for at least that nighttime portion of Halloween. I mean, my mom makes like chili dogs and there's powdered donuts with jelly eyeballs in them and a caramel corn and all the candy. And I'm just going to try not to make myself sick. That's pretty much my goal. And I never really accomplished that either. So it's like, how do I be a human and enjoy these without cutting myself too much slack because I do not like excuses. But let's be real. Like, this is not perfect timing, and there never is. But like, this is really not perfect timing. So I'm still deciding exactly what the boundaries are and the limitations that are going to be. What I've really accepted personally is that I'm going to be dieting a little bit longer, most likely through the holidays, because I am going to enjoy these holidays and not stress about the amount of food I'm eating. I might put a time limit on when I allow to eat, because if you say, hey, you know, I can go to this Friendsgiving, but I can only eat during this 1 hour, it limits the amount of damage you can do in that hour. So I am considering those types of things just to be honest with myself and really not to backtrack, because you can undo a whole week in a day. I mean, I can do that. I mean, my stomach is more than capable of just turning into a pure garbage disposal. So I don't want that to happen. I'm already happy with my progress. And yeah, I mean, I also want to hit 5 watts per kilo before the end of the year. And it's possible, but I got to be on point at least for the next few months to make that happen. So with a drop in body weight, a little boost in FTP, I can be right there. And I can also collect all this great content that will be useful for you guys and help support you through the process. So that's what I'm thinking about. I don't know. I'm excited. I want to be open and honest with you guys that it's not going to be this perfect 30 days for me. It's going to be a little extended and have a little bit more flexibility. And I hope you're okay with that, because I think the January challenge is going to be pretty strict. But I don't know. I'll find clarity. And I'm just happy right now I have time to really nail it down for you guys. So it's a good process. So stay tuned for that Dialed Health Shred coming in January. And that's pretty much it, you guys. Thanks for listening. Let's go to the outro. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Dialed Health Podcast. I really hope it adds some value to your week and just gets you pumped up to get your 2 total body strength sessions in per week on top of your riding without fail. I want you adding in that mobility, taking care of your body, be accountable for not only who you are now, but what you want to be and whatever it's going to take to get you there. Is it worth it? Is the juice worth the squeeze? You know what? I promise that it is. At least go and find out for yourself. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave me a review on Apple. You can leave me 5 stars and a little like, yo, I love that topic about protein powder. Thank you so much. That'd be amazing. And if you also want to screenshot this episode and post it to your Instagram story, that would be great. Please make sure you tag me and I'll repost it. And if you want to send my profile to friends, if you want to send this episode to a friend, I'd really appreciate it. You can text it to them. All of that just has such a huge impact. So I thank you for the support. I hope you have an absolutely great week, and we'll talk to you next Wednesday. Start moving forward.